Let's go.
You're listening to Making Data Simple, where we make the world of data effortless, relevant, and yes, even fun.
Podcast listeners, Al Martin here with Making Data Simple. Hope you are well. I am back in the office today, so I do have my fancy microphone, although sometimes I don't know if it's better or worse, but we're going to find out today. And we're going to find out with Cody Schneider. He's the co-founder of Swell AI and DraftHorse AI. These are two AI content creation platforms that help businesses scale content production. He's got over 10 years of experience in digital marketing and entrepreneurship. He's helped launch and scale numerous startups. And prior to founding his own companies, he held marketing leadership roles in health tech, including the unicorn Rupa Health, where he helped them grow from $20 million to $120 million in valuation. To understand, you're an avid skier and adventurer. We're going to have to talk about the latter one. Anytime anybody says adventurer, you've got to dive into that. But I know you're also passionate about emerging technologies. Thank you for being here. I greatly appreciate it. We're going to have some fun today.
Awesome. We're happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
Guys, you got to visualize Cody here. Most people are behind a desk. He's just sitting there ready to go, with just holding his own microphone. He's done this before. This is like old hat to Cody.
I got my shoes off and I'm barefoot too, if that helps you paint a picture. So.
I didn't need to know that, but that's cool.
Early stage founder stuff, you know, like build a home office. And
this is like Steve Jobs, early days, barefoot and ready to go. Fantastic. Well, speaking of, let's hear a little bit about yourself, what your experience is, what brought you here or what brings you here. But I gave a little bit of an introduction, but why don't you give it a go?
Yeah. So started out my career really working. The big initial step was I started doing some stuff in e-com, specifically large data analytics for just a company that I was running. That I evolved into working at a B2B marketing agency where I helped like Fortune 500 companies that were in the building materials space transition from physical media into digital. So my job there was helping with digital strategy. It's this agency called Reynolds and Myers. They're based out of the Boise, Idaho area. And yeah, so that's kind of where I really cut my teeth on the whole B2B side, where, you know, purchasing decision time horizons are, you know, 3+ years easily for a lot of these larger deals. And so how do you, you know, cultivate relationships and do account-based marketing and kind of, you know, really just demand generation in a very commodity, like, you know, differentiation is just really hard, right? When you're selling a 2x4 as an example. But yeah, so in 2016, kind of built my first software, super small, just like a Chrome extension that was in a data extraction tool. After the marketing agency, I did some consulting and then ended up in the Valley out in San Francisco working for a company called Rupa Health. I was employee 6 there, ended up helping them go from a $20 million valuation to a $120 million valuation in about 6 months. My job there was basically zero to wanting a lot of the media production side. We were really obsessed with this idea of like every company is turning into a media company. So how do we actually do that? So that what we ended up creating was we spun up live classes that happened weekly where we'd host medical practitioners that they would talk about some, we were a lab test marketplace just for context for everybody. So that's what Rupa does, is it basically all these specialty labs in a single location. But yeah, so we spun that up, spun a podcast up as well. And then we basically repurposed all that content into clips and articles and, you know, posts for social, blog posts, newsletters, et cetera. And we ended up taking that podcast from zero to a top 10 medical podcast in the US in about 5 months. Did about 140,000 downloads after that 5 month period, 140,000 downloads a month after that 5 month period. It's now a top, I think, 100 health podcast in the US. And yeah, they're still just kind of cracking away. But anyway, so from there, I left Rupa and wanted to go do my own thing. And that's actually kind of the origin of Swell. So all the stuff that we were doing at Rupa with a team of 20 plus people all working on content and a bunch of different contractors, that's kind of Swell's original origin. So what we do with Swell is basically content repurposing. So we take source file, it's like source media in the form of video, and we turn that into clips, blog posts, newsletters, et cetera. And we're really obsessed with like AI-driven content marketing workflows. We can dive into that deeper. But the idea is basically, you know, everybody is, what we're trying to do is say, hey, people, like, don't change how you're doing things currently. Like, just look at your current workflows. What can I automate, you know, with AI and implementing these tools that are out there? If I can get, you know, 40 or 50% of that heavy lifting to be done by these like pieces of software. That's really the value, right? So anyways, yeah, but happy to dive deeper on any of those pieces.
Oh, look, there's a lot to dive in on. And when we finish the podcast, we'll have to talk about my own podcast here and what you can do. We're like 35,000 downloads, and I thought I was doing good, but 120.
No, you're crushing it. I mean, I think for if you're over 4,700 downloads a month, you're in the top 1 percentile of like all podcasts globally. So yeah, you're, wow. You're way up there. You're in that probably that point, you know, 0.1% of all shows. So
well, that makes me feel good. that explains why all the brokers are calling me, 100%. which is cool. No, so awesome. Hey, well, by the way, you mentioned something. How do you differentiate a 2x4?
It depends how you want to go into it. So there are a lot of the larger wood manufacturing companies. So an example of this is like Boise Cascade or Weyhaeuser. They're moving a lot towards composites. So where they like imagine plywood, but they're doing that with like these woods. So imagine all these different beam types that are, you know, basically specific dimensions, and then using these different composite materials. So that's kind of the biggest thing that they were pushing while I was there was like, how do we sell more of these composite like beams? And so anyways, yeah, that was kind of random knowledge about that. I could talk like windows, like shower bases, like wood products,
awesome.
And like food manufacturing as well. We worked with some of like the major food manufacturing companies. So super random stuff. But anyway.
Does that make you a do-it-yourselfer or no?
Yeah. I mean, right now I live in Denver, Colorado. Don't have a ton of space to really work on. We're renting like a townhouse. But I'm from Idaho originally and probably will end up there long term. You know, my dream is just like to have a ranch out in the woods with wow. a bunch of horses and go skiing and, I don't know, go into the city when we want to and have like a night out, that type of thing, and then come back to the piece. So anyway.
So I know we're going all over the place, but speaking of skiing, avid skier, what's avid skier mean?
Yeah, I mean, it used to be where all my money went. Now it's a little less, my time is a little more constrained. So, but I, you know, had 100+ day seasons, used to travel.
100 day seasons.
For sure, yeah. Used to travel a ton, just like chasing. Actually, how I met my girlfriend, I was like on a ski trip living out of a van with my buddy, and we just randomly ran into each other. And yeah, long story short, it's like 4 years later now. But yeah, so kind of that was a big part of my life at one point. And it is, you know, it's a smaller part of it now, but yeah.
So obviously you're a competitive skier then.
Yeah, yeah. Growing up, I was. I did ski racing and then did free ride type skiing. So did slope style and half pipe. And I like things that go fast and that are kind of dangerous. So I always joke that like, that's what kind of gave me a good risk tolerance for like early stage. I love early stage startups. That's my like preference, like stuff that's right. 0 to 1. Like how do you just like will and things into existence and bend reality to make them real? I think that all this kind of background with these high stakes or high risk type stuff is, anyway, if you're looking for like good entrepreneurs, just go to action sports, and if you're trying to write checks to good company, like people that are probably going to win, it's them. So
what does it take to be like a Olympic skier? If you're skiing 100 days out of the year, that's a third of the year.
Yeah. I mean, for a lot of them, it's the kind of, it's that thing. It's basically they're spending that much time on snow, and then they'll also do like training. I lived in Salt Lake City for 2 years. So like had friends that like went to the show or went to the Olympics and basically did that whole gig. And for them, I mean, majority of them, like while we were in school and stuff, they would take off like all of the winter season and basically be on the circuit, that type of thing. But it was just hilarious because like, you know, months before we're going out getting, you know, drinking in a tent up in the mountains, right? Like by like a mountain lake. And then 2 months later, they win, you know, the golden half pipe at the Olympics. It's kind of a wild crowd. But anyway.
Well, it sounds like fun, but we digress. That's okay. So what's your experience in? Is it marketing? Is that where you went to, go to school for marketing or what?
No, I studied economics in college. I was always obsessed with big data and like trend analysis. That was what was kind of interesting. Somehow I ended up, I was one of those people that was like, how do you sell things on the internet when you're, you know, 15, 16? I had a little bit of background in graphic design, and that kind of like led me into these platforms like Etsy and, you know, all of these other places. I started out doing print on demand. For people that don't know, that's basically where it's like fulfillment done by other companies. So you create like graphic designs, you put it on like a mock-up, and then you can sell it across, you know, websites or these platforms like Etsy or, you know, Amazon, et cetera. And basically that fulfillment company will handle all the printing and shipping of it. And so you're just basically like a middleman for this. So kind of the niche that I initially got started in was analyzing like what was the most, you know, the best selling, you know, anything that you can imagine from keychains to stickers to sweatshirts to t-shirts, et cetera, finding the best-selling products, basically having an offshore team of graphic designers make versions of those, and then we'd list them and basically get them to rank on those platforms. And yeah, so that on it really is how I got into marketing. Naturally, with anybody that's in marketing, what we found is they start off doing some sketchy thing on the internet, like affiliate or drop shipping or whatever. And then somehow they end up in B2B SaaS because that's where all the money is. And right, I think I followed that same path, basically. So
what does early stage mean to you? Is this prior to venture funding? Is it just bootstrap mode or what is it?
Yeah. So typically they have product market fit. So they have like early like customers, maybe like 1 to 10 of them. I've worked with companies that are funded, that aren't funded, mainly anymore work with companies that are funded just because, it just allows for like a lot quicker, like speed. The thing that I'm really focused on is like, is there a target audience that they're trying to get in? Like, or really what I specialize in is like, you know, that there's a customer that's trying to buy this. You don't know how to get in front of them. You don't know how to like get your first, you know, 1,000 customers to hit a million ARR. And so that's what I would come in and basically help these companies do when I was doing consulting was build out, you know, a lot of the times it was the same combination of stuff. Like we're going to scrape all of your target customers' emails, do ads across all platforms to them. So Facebook, Instagram, or Facebook, LinkedIn, Google. So we basically take that email list, you import it into each of those channels. You can do a customer match list so that you can actually run ads to them. Then going to spin up a podcast. we're going to email that podcast. So grow a newsletter for that podcast to that email list. So imagine you had 30,000 emails that you scraped. You just slowly start to sequence them in. You can add about 5,000 a month. And then, you know, about what we've done before in the past is about 6 month period. You can have 30,000 people on that list that are receiving that podcast that you're sending out on a weekly basis. Open rates we've seen on that are in the range of like 60%+ with click-through rates of like 5%. It's the most insane thing. People don't think that podcasts are marketing yet. And so because of that, they're like receptive. It's just like this informational thing. It's educational, right? So their open rates are crazy. They're super receptive to this. This will all burn out. You know, we're kind of in an arbitrage moment right now with this, but I give it 3 to 5 years before this is gone. But with that said, from what we saw is that, hey, you know, we could have founders, they could reach out to their target customers and be like, yo, I want you to come on this podcast episode, talk, you know, and it basically was an excuse to like have an hour long conversation with their target customer that would buy their product, right? So it's it was like a disguised way to do sales. And then that episode, chop it up into clips, chop it up into LinkedIn posts, repurpose the transcript into LinkedIn posts, into tweets, blog posts, into newsletters, et cetera. And, you know, for an hour of time a week, a founder could have all the media that they need to like post across all the channels that their target customer is on. And, you know, the companies that I work with or companies I worked with in the past, we ended up taking them from like, you know, 10 customers to they're at 500 and they hit their first, you know, their milestone of a million ARR, and then they can go raise their Series A round. So mainly like seed and Series A companies is what I work with.
Awesome. So is this all Swell AI you're talking about or DraftHorse? I don't know the difference.
Yeah. So DraftHorse was actually, we spun it out of Swell. It was an internal tool that we built and I was talking about it in public on Twitter. And then people wanted access to it. It's basically, Swell is content repurposing powered by AI. You give it source files and then it can turn it into, you know, any template that you can imagine. You can define the tone, style, and voice. It makes clips. It does auto cropping. It does captions on those clips, et cetera. So it's kind of just like a multimedia repurposing engine. DraftHorse was a programmatic SEO tool that we built to bulk write like thousands of articles based off of target keywords related to our, like what our target customer would be searching. So talking about it in public, spun it out because people were asking for it. It ended up going viral and it did, it got to like 10,000 AR or MRR in the first month.
Wow.
It was kind of wild. Yeah. So it's really, it was kind of a flash in the pan though. It's still alive and kicking. We still have a customer base, but our real focus is on Swell at this point, that content repurposing piece, just because this is really what brands are trying to do. Like they have source file, like media, So say, for example, here's these three different blog posts and I'm trying to write a new blog post about XYZ keyword. Like that's what I'm, you know, trying to create. Or if I have a podcast episode that I recorded or a webinar recorded and I'm trying to turn that into other media, it's like a, you know, something that marketing teams can sit on top of. So
why can you do this better than somebody just doing it for themselves? I mean, is it the tooling? Is it like DraftHorse? Is it just your industry knowledge? Or what is the clear differentiator that says, hey, look, you can try this, but you're not going to get it done? Here's why.
Yeah. Our big thing, again, that I'm obsessed with as a marketer is like, I'm trying to create, you know, content outcomes. And what that means is like, you know, here's this output that I'm wanting to get generated. I don't want to chat with AI, right? Like I could go and I could take an hour long episode of a podcast and I could, you know, create a transcript. I take that transcript, I drop it into ChatGPT. I do my prompt engine, you know, I do my chain of prompts to get the like show notes that I'm looking for. And then I create a whole new chat and I do the chain of prompts that I need to get the blog post I'm looking for. And then I start a whole new chat and I do the, you know, the newsletter prompts to get the output that I'm looking for. Our goal is really like, okay, once you've figured out these outputs and these chain of prompts, we call it prompt chaining, where it's like, oh, say you're trying to write a blog post. It's like, okay, here's this transcript. Now, define the tone, style, and voice of this transcript. Now, write me a detailed blog post outline based off of this transcript's like key insights. Now, write me a blog post in the tone, style, and voice based off of this output or based off of this outline that it generated. That whole thing can be saved as a template. So you never have to chat with AI again is the idea. So once you've figured out the AI like chain to create the output that you're looking for, you can just save that as a template. You provide raw materials and it creates that output every time. So the analogy I've been using is like similar to oil. So we take like crude oil, which is content. So like a, you know, an hour long video podcast, and we turn that into aggregate, into plastics, into gasoline, into diesel, into petroleum jelly, any of these things that you're trying to create from that raw material. That's what we're really focused on, is building that tool that you can build workflows that generate those outputs for people. So,
I mean, look, I could see on the surface, I mean, you guys have been doing it and I'd want somebody to do the legwork for me, particularly in trying to determine what the tone should be.
Yeah.
But could not, how do I say this? Could someone not do that themselves? They could even get iMovie out and like cut it up and, you know, then throw it on Twitter or something. Can they do that? Or you say, no, they can't do that. And here's why.
Yeah, I mean, 100% they could do it. I mean, our big thing is just like taking that heavy lifting, right? Like what used to take. So for example, we have a client, they have like 300 shows that they're running on top of us with. We cut their costs down by like 60%. And it's purely just like the time that it took their team to like build all of that content output for them. So it's really just like a cost cutting function. And for a lot of these companies that are built on top of us, it allows for them to take on more client work, but still charge the same prices that they were previously. Right. Or they reduce their costs, so they become more competitive in the market. So, you know, going from 3,000 a month to 2,000 a month, but now they can manage, you know, we'll say 50% more clients than they were previously using these AI tools to power them. So it's really the, like, you know, if you wanted to go do video editing and go do, you know, like basically write all of this content for every channel based off of this transcript, like that's hours of time that you would take. In 3 minutes, you can have it written and created, like all the clips done, all the content written, and like it's basically ready to be scheduled to any platform that you're trying to get on. So that's kind of the core value prop that we're
making. Makes sense. When you're working with your clients, is success determined, or how are you monetized? I mean, do they put targets like number of new clients, MRR, as a result of your actions, or is it just time and materials? I mean,
yeah,
how are
so
you?
We're just software as a service. So we charge on a cost per upload. So it's basically like, I think our base tier right now is like $29 a month. And you get 5 hours of upload time per month. So upload time is just like the total episode length being uploaded. So as an example, like you can upload a 30-minute episode and a 45-minute episode, and that only counts towards, you know, an hour and 15 minutes of your total upload time available. And then once that media is within Swell, you can write an unlimited amount about that. You can make unlimited clips. So the idea and like where we're headed with this is like what we want to create is a content library that every company can just go back and data mine basically and pull new content from that entire content library that they've like created within us. So there's these tools, they're called like, I can't remember the name of them right now, but it's basically like, imagine like enterprise Google Drive. It's like a digital asset management system, I think is what they're called. And like for them, it's just basically a place to store multimedia and like have it be searchable. And what we're kind of looking at this as in the market opportunity is, hey, take that digital asset management system, but build it from the ground floor up using these AI tools so that you can not just pull that media or find that media. I can create new things with that media using this AI, or like select, you know, multiple source files, like find me everything, you know, any time that telehealth was mentioned in our entire back catalog library, pull out that information and now write me an article on, you know, the trends of telehealth in 2024 or something like that. So,
do you keep create a data fabric then behind the scenes of the, of this? Cause I imagine you're almost creating a, like you said, everybody's a media company. I always say everybody's a technology company, so everybody's a media company too. It's almost like everybody's a television network, meaning you take all their digital streaming, you archive it, and then in future, if they ever want to reuse it, then they just go grab it.
Exactly. Yeah. So where we see this going, and basically what our clients are asking for is now like social scheduling. So like imagine I have this content library of, you know, 300 plus episodes of video, and I'm trying to schedule out across TikTok, YouTube Shorts, Instagram. I'm also trying to schedule out tweets and LinkedIn posts and blog posts to my site. And also maybe like, you know, I'm trying to do an email newsletter. So all of that can live within a single platform. I can pull from that back catalog library of content. And basically, you know, what we see is like we can take like a 10x marketer and they can sit on top of us and they're suddenly like a 100x marketer, right? So if you have somebody that's like, and that's what these AI tools are really like, the impact that it has, like the people that are really good at what they do, when they augment themselves with AI, they become even more like powerful than they were before. And like another example of this is in like software engineering. So like my co-founder, like he's a unbelievable engineer. Like you give him, now he has like Copilot, and he also works in this IDE that's called Cursor, which is basically, it has the context of the entire code base. And he, like an example of this is like, we needed a WordPress plugin so that we could send data from Swell to WordPress. My co-founder doesn't write PHP at all. He's never written a WordPress plugin. He wrote, like, we got this feedback from a customer. 2 hours later, it was live in the product. And like people were sending data with it. And like he wrote that entirely with code that was generated by AI, but he knows how to like tell it basically to do what he needs it to do, right? And so that's kind of the, like, you're going to see these companies that, and it's already starting to happen, where it's like less than 10 people and they're doing 100 million ARR. Like that's an inevitability that's going to come from this because of all of the augmentation that's coming from these AI tools. So,
you know, somebody said that recently. Well, I think it might be in Sam Altman with AI, what he was talking about. When will be the first, I don't remember, billion-dollar company of one?
Yeah.
Of one person.
I think like that is definitely on the horizon, just based off what we're seeing. Like a great example of like how, and that's also just this like cost-cutting like tool, right? So like, I'm trying to think, is it Afterpay? Yeah. Afterpay, I think they just like automated 60%, 40 to 60%, don't quote me on this, of their like customer service queries. This was like a couple months ago. And it just like, it basically like overnight, they were like, oh, like we could, all they did was they trained a chatbot off of their internal like knowledge-based documentation, like customer, you know, service center. Mm-hmm. And then people could ask questions against it. It goes back to that library, you know, library of information, pulls back the relevant information, anything that, you know, it can't answer, it gets elevated to a person. But, you know, within a quarter, they basically like reduce their costs dramatically. And suddenly, I mean, you see a stock price jump because of that, right? So that's how we see all of this happening, is like these companies are going to adopt as much as they can, like especially software companies that are like high engineering driven organizations. It's just going to be where they end up going because it's just so cost effective to do it. I mean, yeah, it's crazy. Yeah,
makes perfect sense. Yeah. So are these AI tools you continue to reference, are they all in-house stuff, tools that you've developed, or is it more like a foundational model that you're using?
Yeah. So we use all models that are available that are public. We are wanting to use more open source, but the quality hasn't been at the level that we're looking for. Where we see this going is we think open source is going to win. So that's probably like where it heads. So we're just using off the shelf models and then combining all of these different AI models together. So for example, we use like a transcription model. We use clip identification models. We use auto cropping models that like, you know, basically do facial recognition to like center a person within a, like a portrait clip. So like you could give it a landscape video and it will like center the person. And then if there's two people talking, we have it. So it like auto cuts back and forth between those people. So it actually does like, you know, basically like identifies when who's the active speaker is. And then also like, you know, the LLM, large language models on top of that. So we're, you know, we want to go with all this, but it's always just a matter of time is build a foundational model that's specific to the use cases that we're trying to do. So all of these like general models are trained off of the, you know, average of the internet. Or, you know, off of the whole internet. And if you've been on the internet, you know that it's not really a top 10 percentile place. There's a lot of garbage out there. And so garbage in, garbage out. So if you prompt it like, hey, like find me, you know, a viral clip within this transcript, it's going to do a terrible job at doing that. But if you train the model off of just viral clips that happened on YouTube, TikTok, Instagram Reels, et cetera, you can then go back and it's going to basically be like only identify those top performing things. Same thing, like you could use this for like writing blog content that you want to, like to rank on the front page of Google. Instead of training it on the entire internet of like, here's how a blog post looks, you just train it on the front page search results of Google. And then that foundational model can be used. The challenge with this is that to like change a train a foundational model now, I mean, it's in the range of millions. That's why all these companies are raising that are trying to do this. Our friends, there's a company that they just started called SF Compute. It's growing stupid fast. But if you just go to sfcompute.com, you can see it's like the most basic website ever. But imagine it's just like basically a marketplace for GPU training. So like say you're a startup or you're an academic at Oxford or you're, you know, like a AI researcher within a larger organization. You would go to them and you'd basically like buy compute time to train your own foundational model, whether that's doing fine tuning or you're like from, you know, just an entirely new model. It's just cost prohibitive at this point. And that's why a lot of these startups, like including us, are basically pulling in all of these tools that we can identify as being what's necessary to create the outputs that our users are looking for. So long-winded.
No, that was great because I was going to ask, and you asked, at least answered part of it at the end. I was going to ask you, how the hell are you affording to train these models? And are you training them on client-specific data then? Because I'm with you. I mean, this is what I do for a living. And, you know, a couple things, you know, one is, I say this over and over, but it continues to be the case. Fake news scares me. So that means you've got to make sure that you get accuracy. And to get accuracy, you're going to have to use some form of like RAG or fine tuning against client specific data. Then I'm thinking, well, how are you going to afford this? Particularly if you're building some of this, because you're, it sounds like you're building, you need the GPUs and maybe you're going to like SF Compute. I don't know, but I guess, I don't know. I'll stop there. I mean, that's my question is, you know, how are you really designing, or I presume you're going straight off the client data to get rid of the some of the bias and the fake news and all that stuff.
Yeah. I mean, what we found is that when you limit the source context that you provide to the AI, the output ends up being like very close to what you provided. So for example, like we take this episode and we transcribe it. And then we're like, hey, AI, write a blog post based off of this episode, use the vocabulary that's used in this transcript. And, you know, maybe here's a brand voice and a persona of, like, say you're trying to write from the perspective of you, Al, right? Like, so it sounds like it's, you know, you that's writing the article.
Yeah.
The output that we can get from that is like 95% of what a human can do. And it can do it in, you know, 8 seconds. And then, you know, that person comes over the top, they maybe do, you know, final touch changes, and that's live on the website within 5 minutes. So that's how, like, and this is again, what I'm obsessed with. Like when I go and prompt, like, and for the majority of people, like the only way that they've interacted with AI so far is that they've gone to ChatGPT and they're like, do something, you know, write something for me. And they're like, oh, well, it only can write generic things. It only can do these outputs that are not human. And that's totally true because it's trained off of like the general knowledge of the internet, right? But what we found is that when you give it this walled garden of, hey, here's the source files that you're basically going to be working off of for this activity. So again, just to use this blog post example, writing this blog post, when you limit the source files of that they can use to basically perform that prompt that you're giving them, the output quality is like 10x of what it would be if you just prompted it like, you know, hotel marketing strategies. To give a concrete example of this, like say I go and I interview like 5 hotel marketing experts, right? I sit down with them for 30 minutes. I transcribe this whole conversation. I then take all those transcripts. I put it in a context window and I say, okay, like we're going to write a blog post based off of the source file information that I just provided you. The output that I'm going to get from the interviews, that blog post output is going to be 10x better, if not 100x better than what I get if I just prompt the AI, hey, write me hotel marketing strategy, like, you know, write a blog post about hotel marketing strategy. And so the human part of this, like that source file, that source material, that back catalog of content, that's going to be like, it's really going to be a moat for these companies long-term. Like it's why Gartner, it's why Deloitte, it's like why all these companies are holding all this data so close to the vest, and like why these other AI like companies like Mistral is like, hey, we want you to be able to run our models on-prem so like none of this data leak happens, because that's your differentiator in what you're selling your target market, right? So.
Hey, podcast listeners, Al here. Thank you for listening. I greatly appreciate it. Hopefully you're enjoying the podcast. I'm going to stop this podcast with Cody here because this podcast just continued to build. It was a lot of fun. And the next part of this podcast, I'll just tell you, we started out with a favorite question of mine right now is if he would short NVIDIA. And that gets into the state of the industry. And then we just go from there. So I wanted to cut it here and we'll come back next week and we'll finish it up. Thank you.